Coming up.
Everyone says anarchism is great in theory, but it's terrible in practice, and it's actually the other way around.
Anarchy, dream or nightmare?
Doesn't anarchy necessarily mean chaos, destruction, and violence?
Anarchy is not chaotic, it's organized. It's actually capitalism that's chaotic and uses the state to enforce its order.
Is the state always coercive?
First definition of politics is always making people do things they don't want to do.
Can we have true freedom and autonomy while being ruled by others?
Do we need the state, or is it just something the state has convinced us of?
I think it's interesting to think about what it would be like to not have government.
Our guest is James Martel, editor of How Not to Be Governed, readings and interpretations from a critical anarchist left.
When people actually have an experience of getting to decide things for themselves, they become incredibly excited. It really changes the way you think about things.
Anarchy, dream or nightmare?
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the Mars Theater, the San Francisco's breeding ground for new performance.
Our thinking originates at Philosopher's Corner. That's at the Stanford campus. That's where Ken teaches philosophy, and I taught philosophy for 40 years.
Welcome, everyone, to Philosophy Talk. And today we're philosophizing about anarchy, utopian dream or dystopian nightmare.
Well, anarchists believe that all forms of government, whether we're talking about democracy, socialism, communism, all illegitimate.
Now, why on earth would anybody believe that?
Because it's obviously true. I mean, governments are based on coercion. State coercion means tyranny. Tyranny is bad.
But how could we provide for public goods like education, healthcare, and infrastructure if there was no state? Come on, who would ensure law and order, John?
Ensure law and order? Surely I don't need to remind you, the father of a black teenager, of what so-called law and order amounts to in our country, where police can just kill with impunity. Give me anarchy over that kind of law and order any day.
Oh, John, but that's a false choice. I'll grant you some states are unjust. Maybe all states are unjust. But that doesn't mean that we should totally abolish the state. We just need to make them more just. I mean, surely more justice is preferable to anarchy in which, anything goes. Come on.
Well, why do you say in anarchy anything goes? That's a very naive point of view. Do you think abolishing the state would turn us all into thieves and murderers? Why do you have such a low opinion of humankind?
It's not just my opinion. Haven't you read your Hobbes? I mean, in his great book, The Leviathan, he argued that in the state of nature, which is just another name for anarchy, life would be nasty, brutish, and short. I think Hobbes had a great insight into human nature.
I thought he said nasty, British, and short.
He said brutish and short.
Oh, brutish. Oh, okay, well... But why would that be?
Because he claims human greed, avarice, and rapaciousness knows no natural bounds. We need the state to keep our natural instincts and to keep ourselves in check.
Well, we can keep each other in check. Most of us are not that rapacious and avaricious. We don't need the state.
Oh, come on, be real. Okay, I'll give you an example. Suppose that you and I right here, we're going to make a business deal with one another. I'll pay you up front right now to provide me a certain service. But suppose we're an anarchic system. There are no laws that forbid cheating, no police to arrest you, no courts to imprison you. What's to stop you from taking my money and running? Altruism? You just like me so much?
Not altruism, just common sense. I'd be an idiot to cheat my customers, especially if they're big and strong like you. None of them, if I did that, they wouldn't return. That's no way to build a business.
Well, John, people do cheat each other all the time.
Which shows how ineffective states are at preventing it. Apparently it goes on in spite of the fact that we're part of all these states. What do you want? Why do you want to give the states more power? you kind of like tyranny, don't you?
No, you like chaos. That's your problem. You like chaos.
I like freedom and autonomy.
Oh, yeah, freedom and autonomy are good things, but how does anarchy enhance either of them?
Well, state coercion diminishes freedom and autonomy. Get rid of the state, get rid of the coercion, autonomy and freedom automatically increase.
You're confusing liberty with license. Without the state to protect it, there's no genuine liberty.
Communism, fascism, theocracy, you think they're there to protect liberty?
No. States like that rule without the consent of the governed. When a state has the consent of the governed, it's not tyrannical anymore. Haven't you read your Jefferson?
Does the state ever ask if you want to submit to its authority? Would it be willing to take no for an answer? I don't think so.
In a democracy, actually, the state does ask for your consent. That's what elections are about. It's not arbitrary. It's not tyrannical. It's democracy.
Well, it's just a more subtle form of tyranny than the others. I get to vote for Tweedledum or Tweedledee. Usually one is about as bad as the other. How is that not arbitrary?
Okay, I'm going to grant you democracy may not be perfect, but you got to admit, it beats anarchy.
You just don't have enough imagination. And imagine a world free from all arbitrary authority. No nations, no religion too. Imagine a world in which everyone gets to decide for themselves what to do and under what conditions based on their own desires, interests, and values. Can't you imagine that? That's anarchy.
Oh, God, John, that's a lovely utopian fantasy. It's just a fantasy. You haven't convinced me at all that it would work, like, in the real world, in the here and now.
Well, maybe this will help you channel your inner John Lennon that I know is there. Lots of people are actually trying to make anarchy work in movements large and small. And we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Shuka Kalantari, out to take a close-up look at anarchy in action. And she files this report.
Once a month, people in cities across the country hop onto their bikes, form into large groups, and stop rush hour traffic. It's called Critical Mass, and it started in the early 90s as a way to promote bike culture.
There's nobody running it. Otherwise, someone would be responsible for anything that happens, and then you would need a permit.
That's Norm. I met him at Critical Mass in San Francisco, where the movement started. He's been doing this for 15 years. He says he loves it because it isn't centrally organized.
So we have no permit, so we have no leader. We have no destination. We just go this way and that way and this way and that way, and we're not even sure which way we're going when we get till we get there.
Okay, that's fine for bicycles, but could this model work for a government?
Most people need leadership, otherwise they'll go chaos and, you know.
Most everyone I talk to feels the same way. Anarchy leads to chaos. But there's one group that thinks anarchy would work on a larger scale. Anarchists.
People like to look at the Spanish Civil War and how the anarchists were able to take the means of production and make self-governed societies.
Like Gray Corton of Oakland, California.
It's a good example of how anarchism can work.
These anarchists played a big role in the fight against Francisco Franco during the Spanish Civil War, even though they lost and Franco became dictator. But it wasn't Spanish history that got Horton into anarchism. It was punk music. Specifically a band called Against Me.
They have the song Baby I'm an Anarchist. It's a protest song, essentially, basically saying that I am not going to relate to liberalism, and if I want to break windows, that's my thing because I'm an anarchist.
So do you break windows?
I would never say that on record.
Horton was also inspired by writings from Crime Think Collective, a decentralized anarchist group that publishes books.
One being Days of War, Nights of Love, which is a very romantic book about how you can sit on abandoned buildings and watch the sunset and make out and eat from dumpsters. And like reading this as a 16-year-old kid, you're like, I want to do that. I want to ride trains and explore abandoned buildings and sort of live this free lifestyle.
Horton was too scared to ever hop on any trains. Today he's a web developer, but he still loves anarchy. In fact, he throws parties where they hand out anarchist pamphlets and listen to local punk bands.
So I guess if it's an anarchist party, wouldn't they just play whenever they wanted to play, or?
As much as I love good chaos, anarchism isn't chaos. Chaos is an event. Chaos is a thing that happens. Anarchism is a whole philosophical framework of ideas.
And there's different ways to do it. There's individual anarchists. They value individuals over society. And there's collective anarchists, people who oppose private ownership of any kind. Horton really believes that an anarchist society could function.
People think of anarchism as being this event-driven project where we are all working towards the event, meaning that like the revolution or the collapse or something. So it's not this static event-based philosophy, but something that is going to be constant.
Horton says it's a way to constantly challenge authority. If anarchists work together towards a decentralized society, it doesn't have to lead to chaos. So what does anarchists working together look like? Anything from battling Franco during the Spanish Civil War to handing out pamphlets at a punk party. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Shuka Kalantari.
Thanks, Shuka, for telling us, introducing us to some real live anarchists and anarchy-inspired events right here in the Bay Area. I'm John Perry, along with my fellow Stanford philosopher, Ken Taylor, and we're coming to you from the lovely Marsh Theater in San Francisco.
Our guest today is a professor of political science at San Francisco State University. He's editor of How Not to Be Governed, Readings and Interpretations from a Critical Anarchist Left. Please welcome to the Philosophy Talk stage, James Martell.
James, you research and write a lot about anarchistic movements in Spain and elsewhere, and sounds like you've got one going with this crowd right here. What got you interested in this particular topic in the first place?
Well, I think I was an anarchist my whole life. One of my earliest childhood memories is a big poster of Che Guevara on my parents' refrigerator. Mm-hmm. And on my mom's side, she's a Jew from France, and the police were just bad news when she was growing up, you know, Gestapo. And on my dad's side, you know, kind of Fenian Irish rebels. So I think I just have it in my blood. And
so you're kind of a motorcycle riding yarmulke wearing whiskey drinking anarchist. Okay.
Precisely.
Now, a lot of people, when they think about anarchy, they think, well, yeah, sure, violent, chaotic state, looting, destruction of property, and so forth. Sounds pretty terrifying. How do you calm down? What do you say that you really have in mind with anarchy?
Well, what I would say is the kind of images of chaos and like going running amok are projections that liberal capitalists make to make sure that we don't think of anarchism as a possible alternative to what is it going on. I mean, a lot of people will put up with a lot as long as they think there's no alternative. And there's even an acronym, TINA, there is no alternative, that is trotted out all the time to say, well, I know capitalism sucks and the police kill African-Americans and blah, 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 but there is no alternative.
But you know, it's not just a knee-jerk reaction. I mean, there's a lot of political philosophy, Locke, Hobbes, the whole social contract tradition thinks about the state of nature, which means anarchy in the the absence of government and what would justify it. And they think, well, in the state of nature, we rationally choose this because the state of nature would be so yucky. I mean, we'd be at each other's throats. There'd be no protection of property. So, I mean, that's not a silly thought, is it?
Well, I mean, I teach social contract theory all the time. And the thing that people forget is that Hobbes made that up. Like he just said that's what human nature is, and it's another version of TINA, right? It's saying if you don't have this, then we'll all be killing each other and like stabbing our grandmother and whatever. So obviously
well,
you don't want that.
Well, he was thinking about the England of his day.
Yeah.
It was
kind of going crazy, but a lot of things were happening that he was afraid of, you know, and he was trying to put a lid on it with these kind of fantasies.
When I listen to you and listen to the people that Shuka interviewed. There's different strands. One thing is anarchy versus hierarchy. Mm-hmm. I must admit, I like that very much. I don't see why representative government doesn't mean that the representatives become a privileged class that get to decide for us, like John Boehner does. another thing anarchy seems to mean to people is no state at all. But then when you hear people talk, it's usually not no state at all, but as local a state making decisions as possible. So Which is it? Is there an official definition I can glom onto?
Well, you know, you ask 100 anarchists, you're going to get 100 answers. But I basically think the basic definition is when people make decisions that affect themselves, they suffer the consequences, both good and bad, of their decisions, and they're fully responsible for them. There's no representation. You don't vote for anybody. And that's true on both the political and the economic level.
So we'll have to dig into this. This is complicated stuff. This is Philosophy Talk, coming to you from the Mars Theater. Our guest is James Martel from San Francisco State University, and we're philosophizing about anarchy. Utopian dream or dystopian nightmare?
Are you an anarchist? Do you think it's a system that could work? Or do we need the state to protect our rights and safety?
Anarchy, law, and order, along with questions from our anarchic audience, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Thanks to our musical guests, the Playtones. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is James Martel from San Francisco State University. We're thinking about anarchy, utopian dream, dystopian nightmare.
What would anarchy really look like in practice? Are you part of an anarchist group or organization? What do you think are the greatest challenges for anarchy in order? Join the discussion by stepping up to the microphone in front of the stage, and we're going to have lines in spite of the theme of the day.
So, James, I'm a fan of freedom. Anarchy promises freedom and autonomy. I like that idea. But my worry about an anarchist system is that, well, we'd actually lose a whole lot of what the state provides. We not just law and order, but also things like roads, education, health care, money, patents, innovation. How could we have any of these things under an anarchism? How could we do that?
Well, I think one thing to keep in mind is that states don't build roads. People build roads, right? So, and all those things are built by people, not by states. So the state takes the credit and dominates all these activities, but communities have been building roads for forever with, you know, in various kinds of different ways. And I actually...
The interstate highway system? Didn't the state build that? Say, we want a road system that stretches from shore to shore, north to south, all over the borders. We want everybody to have access. Even those who can't afford to pay for themselves, we're going to pool our resources through taxation. And
well, Eisenhower didn't build it himself. It was like laborers built it, right? So, I mean, the actual building of it happened by regular people. And that's the point, is that you don't need a state to tell you to do things. If a community decides to do something, they could talk to various other communities. They can do anything.
So that sounds good, but realistically... The people that worked on the interstate, I did a little work on interstate when I was a teenager, constructing the one through Lincoln. I got paid. I didn't, with money. Now, as I understand it, one difference between libertarians and anarchists is anarchists don't like capitalism, not meaning they don't like our weird capitalism we have now where corporations are regarded as persons, but they don't like capital. They don't like money. If you don't have money, you can't accumulate money, and you can't have capitalism. Now, how are you going to get the interstate built without money? Is Eisenhower just going to kind of sign a lot of vouchers saying, you know, 1 hour of presidential time for 1 mile of freeway, or how's that going to work?
Well, I mean, there are actually some fights in anarchism about whether to have money or not. I won't go into those.
How are you going to decide?
But I think essentially you don't need money to do things. I mean, there's tons of communities that don't use money and still get things done. And people it can be a barter economy. It can be labor chits. There's been all these kind of different experiments with anarchist groups, and they've managed to build things and do things.
What's the biggest thing has ever been built without the use of money?
Well, I mean, anarchist Spain for about 10 or 15 years ran in, you know, entire cities, you know, Barcelona for one. Complete barter economy.
Okay. I would grant you that you could do things without money. You could do things without states. But once states happen, those are large-scale things that mobilize large masses of people. Now, because of their large-scaleness and the mobilization of large masses of people, every state comes with coercive powers. Mm-hmm. Right. And so sometimes if I'm in a state, I am going to be faced by this thing, which I may have consented to its existence, but its particular actions, it will use its coercive powers to say, yes, we will do this. And it stands against my will. Okay, maybe that's a bad thing. But these large things with these coercive powers can do large things. I mean, it's not clear to me that all the large scale things that states can, maybe some of them are bad, like war is bad, yeah. Right? Yes. But on balance, I'm not quite sure that what anarchy is going to deliver. Is it going to deliver all the large-scale things? Or is it going to say, well, some of the large-scale things we should just do without?
Well, I mean, I guess an anarchist community would have to decide what they wanted to do, and they would do it. And if they didn't have the large-scale things, they would live with that, you know. And if they missed it, then they could do it. It's really not about – I don't think the scale is the problem. I think it's really the coercion that you were talking about before, that's the problem. I mean, if you're building things and you don't want to, I mean, basically, you know, I'm a political science professor. The first definition of politics is always making people do things they don't want to do. And like, that's a very, I would call it archist as opposed to anarchist concept.
And yeah.
I think it's a terrible principle to base our political life.
I want to come back to your positive conception. You, another anarchist, use the word community a lot. And you use the word community as if the community is an agent. It's up to the community to decide. Well, what kind of, what is a community? Why is that not a state, just a very small one, if you mean something like Palo Alto or even San Francisco? San Francisco is bigger than a lot of states historically. Is San Francisco a community? Is just the Haight a community? Is just my household a community? What is it really to say no government, no state, and then to buy this concept of community whenever you need it?
Well, I mean, one of the key principles of anarchism is no representation. So you would never vote for somebody, you would never appoint somebody to speak on your behalf. Mm-hmm. And actually, anarchists have worked out this very kind of elaborate and very well-functioning model where they have these things called affinity groups that was developed in anarchist Spain, where people would of birds of a feather would kind of meet together. And then they would have like what they call a spoke, which is a person who would speak on their behalf, but couldn't innovate, couldn't say anything that they hadn't authorized them to say. And then they would have spokes councils and then general assemblies. So it can work. You can ramp it up to any size you want.
So the idea, though, is I take it what makes it anarchy is that I am never actually faced with something that is to be done contrary to my will.
Right.
That is, so if I mean, we could have the following system. We all directly vote on whether things are to be done. And if any of us says no, nothing happens, because that way nobody is faced with something. That seems kind of impractical.
But is that what you had in mind? That sounds like Quaker consensus.
Yeah.
But you seem to talk about something that sounded like voting on what the spokesman was allowed to say. Would
it's
majority
not,
rule there? How would
no,
it go?
No, no, no. The model that most anarchists use is actually, believe it or not, consensus. And
right.
They have ways of dealing with it. They have this thing called standing aside. So if you don't want to participate in that decision, but you can let the rest of the group do it, you can do that. There's a thing called blocking.
I mean, this is, I think, a deep problem not appreciated enough in sort of liberal democracy. But both de Tocqueville and Mill were struck by the fact and made big deals about the fact that a tyranny of the majority is still a tyranny,
mm-hmm.
Right? Mill says, look, if all but me say X, Y, or Z, and I reject X, Y, Z, and they do X, Y, Z anyway and compel me to, that's tyranny. That's no different from the king compelling me. So the logic of the state is always tyranny, but if you always, never be coerced.
But there was a move there you made,
yeah.
You know. I mean, the king doing something, if that's tyranny, then the majority does that tyranny. No, I mean, that's just using one word where you might have something negative. You might use another word. It's coercion by the majority. But
why is that any more legitimate?
Because in the one case, you have a king who probably claims inherited baloney rights and so forth and so on. I mean, we don't have tyranny of the majority in America because we don't have representative democracy. We have elected hierarchy, right? We elect people like Boehner or you know, Barbara Boxer, or, you know. I mean, the Senate is a different thing. That doesn't even pretend to be.
Yeah.
But the House of Representatives. But we elected people, but they don't go there and, you know, just say what their constituents want them to say.
Well, that's true.
They
right.
go there
yeah.
and become little earls and dukes
in
Washington.
What do you think about this claim?
But that's just my opinion.
The claim of the Mill and de Tocqueville, that the tyranny of the majority is still tyranny and it's no better than Any other kind of tyranny?
I would say two things. First, you're guaranteed tyranny with the state. There's no problem there. So you might have a chance for something else with an anarchist practice at the very least. So that's better already. And secondly, I think that the way the anarchists have worked that out is you get a lot more variation. You get a lot less of a... Because the state demands uniformity, that everyone has to live by the same laws. And an anarchism would allow a lot more variety, a lot more difference. And so tyrannies wouldn't necessarily even happen or apply because you have this ability to sort of step out.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about anarchy, utopian dream or dystopian nightmare in front of a live audience at the Mars Theater. And we've got questioners from that live audience. I'm going to go from one side to the other. We'll start over there. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, ma'am. What's your comment or question?
Thank you. So I wanted to go back to this question of imagination. And it's what I see as the challenge with anarchism. I wouldn't describe myself as an anarchist, but I was part of a very lovely, I think, anarchist experience earlier this week in the streets of Berkeley one evening, part of a march that didn't have a leader but did some, I think, important things in a very lovely way. And I was kind of impressed by how willing I was to do that. But we're also products of the society, and I think that that imposes... limits, very real limits that I think are changeable, certainly, but limits that that provide an obstacle for us being able to transition to something different, right? So I guess I'd like to hear more about that.
Hmm. Well, one of my favorite passages about anarchism is by this wonderful writer named Kathy Ferguson, and she said, "Everyone says anarchism is great in theory, but it's terrible in practice, and it's actually the other way around. Anarchism is a quite not very well articulated theory, but it's wonderful in practice." And I think that's exactly right, that when people actually have an experience of getting to decide things for themselves, they become incredibly excited. It really changes the way you think about things. And I taught a year ago an anarchist class with anarchist pedagogy and let the students do everything. They decided what they were going to do, what the grades are. And it was the best class I ever taught in my life. I've taught for 20 years. And
we could say something because of that.
Anarchy, you use anarchism in a lot of different ways. Certain kinds of events are a lot of fun. I love to be part of anarchistic events and have been. But if the anarchistic event is a coal company in West Virginia refusing to do what the majority of people in West Virginia and the majority of people in America think they should do, if you force them to do it, that doesn't seem to me like tyranny. And if they just don't do it and nobody forces them to it, that doesn't seem like fun anarchy. That seems horrible. So aren't you just using anarchy for the fun parts of of events where there's a relative lack of authority?
Well, except you see, the thing is, if in your example of this coal company in West Virginia, it would be impossible to do that because that's the problem with capitalism. Capitalism builds in these completely anti-democratic features where no one gets any say and they just kind of do what they want. They use their money and power to
force people. This is one of the things I fear about anarchy. They would still develop constellations of power. Corporations would form or something. Well, maybe not corporations because you need something to license the corporation. But anyway, constellations of power of economic actors would form. And at least one of the things you can do in a democracy, this goes back to John's point, is try, mostly fail, but try to democratically regulate them. But if there's an anarchy, that's not going to stop these constellations of power from performing, but then we have no power to democratically regulate them.
Well, I mean, in a way, everything would be democratic. I mean, one of the things I think is anarchy is not chaotic. It's organized. It's actually capitalism that's chaotic and uses the state to enforce its order, because anarchy is everyone will be organized. Everybody will have a say. Everybody will participate.
How do you stop? That's
very democratic.
How do you stop a company from spewing stuff into the water?
Because there would be no company. There's no corporations.
So let's go back a step. We got an anarchist community of 150 people. No companies, no money. Mr. X wants to poop on the street. Nobody else wants him
like
to poop
Diogenes.
On the street. Like Diogenes. I was going to bring up Diogenes. I couldn't remember his name. So they say, you can't poop on the street. Is that tyranny? Has nothing to do with corporations. Has nothing to do with money. It's just sometimes... Doesn't the majority, the overwhelming majority, the community have the right to coerce people not to do certain things, of which I picked a particularly objectionable example for the sake of argument?
Spoken like Hobbes, by the way.
Yeah. Right? I think that, well, first of all, anarchism doesn't mean everyone gets to do whatever they want, because you still have a community. You just have to work it out. That, I mean, there's a lot of an agonic process where you're kind of struggling with each other, and you have, it's a lot of work.
But there's no coercion.
Coercion isn't exactly the right word. It's persuasion. It's working it out. Right. It's politics. My guy
won't be persuaded.
Then you might just have to let you do your pooping.
Let's take some more questions from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Beth.
Hi, my name is Andrea. I'm from the community of the Lower Hate. My question is, in an anarchistic community, how do you account for people who can't participate as actively, maybe because they're sick or they're elderly or they're children? How is that handled if someone can't contribute as much as everyone else?
That's a really good question. I think that, the anarchism, they have a lot of things they're continually working out. But in general, I think, I mean, this is sort of fall back on an earlier answer. You're guaranteed that those people have no voice, because none of us have a voice right now. So at least there's a chance for those kind of people to have a voice. I think.
But wait a minute. But there's a chance within a state. That's one of the things. If you were behind what's called the Rawlsian veil of ignorance, you'd say, we're going to choose a state, and it has to be a state that we could fairly choose, rationally choose, under no system of coercion. And one of the things we know is we're going to go through these seasons of life. I don't know what my life's going to be, but I'm going to go through these seasons of life. I might be disabled. So I got to choose a state that will care for all of these fundamental concerns. And I mean, so that's part of the decision problem of justifying the state, that it will do these things that are last.
I would much more trust the community of which these people are members. In other words, like the children of the parent, of the elderly parents, the parents of the young children, to take in the concerns of these children and elderly and have a voice, than I would a state which has its own interests, which has nothing to do with the community.
Where do you draw the line, but definitionally or in size, between a community and a state?
Well, I mean,
is the United States a community? If we don't look at the government, is it a community?
It's a community, but it's a very big community, and it would take a lot of negotiating and to have an entity of that size kind of work along anarchist principles. I tend to think anarchist communities would have to be quite a bit smaller, but it could work even at that level.
I would assume that an anarchic community is one in which there are no coercive powers. A state has coercive powers and has a monopoly on coercive powers. Right. Communities only have persuasion, among others, and there is no coercion. There's complete autonomy and liberty. I mean, is that a reasonable?
Yeah, I think that's reasonable.
Well, so we've got more questions. We'll start the next segment with questions from our live audience. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're thinking about anarchy with James Martel, editor of How Not to Be Governed, Reading and Interpretations from a Critical Anarchist Left.
How would we go about bringing about anarchy? Does it mean the collapse of our capitalist liberal democracy? Would that mean it could only come about by violent revolution? Are there other paths to anarchy?
We're coming to you from the Mars Theater in San Francisco. We'll take more questions from our live audience, somewhat anarchic, when Philosophy Talk continues.
Sacco and Vanzetti are gone.
Thanks to our live musical guests, the Playtones. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Our guest is James Martel from San Francisco State University, and we're thinking about anarchy. And we've got questions from our live audience here at the Mars. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks. My question is,
us what your name and then where you're from.
My name is Jacques. I'm from Berkeley. And my question is, so I've heard the expression that capitalism is a big cake in the middle of a field, and all along the field are a bunch of people that are making awesome cake cutters to try to get to the cake. But in anarchy, there is no cake, right? So who's going to make the cookie cutters, like the cake cutters, like the iPhone and the TV? Like, who's going to make that? Because there's no real incentive.
Excellent
Great
question.
Question.
How old are you?
13.
Excellent question from the mouths of youth. Okay, James. That's a deep challenge to you.
I think that the state just takes credit for everything. Like, it takes credit for all of human ingenuity and everything that's invented, and as if, like, people wouldn't still invent things if it weren't for states. I mean, you know, I think people invent things for the joy of inventing it because they're smart.
Wait a minute, though. But I think the young man's question is deeper than that. It's not as though the state invents all this stuff. Human beings and innovation invents all this stuff. But why does our Constitution give Congress the right to award patents? How do you protect intellectual property? If you can't protect intellectual property, you can't protect investment. If you can't protect any kind of property, you can't. Now, property, this is one of the things that the social contract theorists seem to believe. Property is not protected in the state of nature. I can't say this is mine and have the right to compel you, to coerce you, not to violate my use of this thing. Property is not a natural thing. It's a state-created, state-endorsed thing. And with property comes the possibility of investment and ownership and all that stuff.
Yeah, I just think that you can still own stuff and not have a state. In other words, communities can enforce ownership and property.
Enforce through coercive powers?
No, through the way communities do things. Like, you know, you don't steal from your next-door neighbor and
you say... the young man says, what's the motivation for inventing if we don't have this cake in the middle? And you say, oh, well, people do it for the fun of it. Well, yeah, people do a lot of inventing and songwriting and novel writing for the fun of it, but they do a heck of a lot not for the fun of it. They do a heck of a lot because of a motivational structure that's made possible by virtue of, what's the word, money, right? Even in relatively small communities, you know, money's a useful tool for motivating. So, I mean, now, if you just tell me, well, we really don't need iPhones and all that stuff, I could probably accept that more than most people. But I don't think you've answered these questions. How do you imagine this working, or do you just imagine it not working, that we have these inventions that people do because they can make a lot of money and because, as Ken points out, it will be protected insofar as it can be by the government and its coercive powers?
A couple of things. First of all, I think... It may well not be. I don't think we'd have as much razzle dazzle as we do right now. And the iPhone, all these things. I mean, they're based on these kind of like huge slave economies in China. I mean, there's a lot of blood under these products that we love so much, and
that's a good point.
Nonetheless, that's sort of the negative version. But the positive version of it is saying that when workers own their own collective work, whatever it is, their farm, their factory, their whatever. There's no boss anymore, and it doesn't mean that they can't do things. In other words, I bet you if I polled the audience, everyone here would hate their boss and know their job better than their boss does. So if you just like took that layer off and had people kind of collectively do what they do, then they could do the same thing they do now.
Then they could hate each other.
They could hate each other.
So help me understand the difference between your view and the Marxist view, because the Marxists looked at capitalism kind of the way you do. It appropriates labor and alienates the laborer from the product of his labor.
Yes.
And we need this worker state, and we need this overthrow of capitalism. But at the end of the day, at the end of history, Marx was an anarchist. That is, he thought the state would wither away, and that would be the full flowering of human potential. The state always gets in the way, but he somehow seemed to believe that you had to have a worker state to destroy the capitalist state, and then the worker state somehow would melt away, and the result would be anarchy.
That's how anarchists differ from communists. You're right. Marx was ultimately an anarchist, but it was a matter of methods. And I think clearly, as history has shown, states don't wither away.
We got a question from our live audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Matt.
Thank you. I'm Pat from Daly City, and your conversation reminds me of a book I read 10 or 15 years ago by Thomas Hartmann that I thought was really brilliant at the time. It was the first I had heard of the problem with corporations being having the rights but not the responsibility of persons, and he talked about the law of the commons, that when you're talking about sizes of communities, I think he said anything over 150 people stop being caring for each other. They don't know, they can't know everyone at that point, everyone else. And so I'm wondering, do any of you think of his work? Is he an anarchist? I had never thought of that at the time. I think this book was called Unequal Protection, and I haven't read any of his work since then.
So what do you think?
I don't know that work, but I would say that number, I don't know, maybe let's just take that number as that's correct. But that doesn't mean that you have to stop there. I mean, like I said, the anarchists have developed methods for various communities and affinity groups to work together on larger and larger scales. So it can ramp up. But I think it is nice to keep the local level at least somewhat small, so that for the reasons you said.
So in small communities, I'm thinking of religious communities that don't believe in physical coercion, they often use other forms that maybe should be called persuasion, but are pretty on the margins, like shunning, right? So my man who poops on the street would be shunned.
Yes.
He might not be forced, he may not be penalized, he might not be fun, but he would be shunned. Do anarchists, or do you have a clear conception of where persuasion leaves off and coercion begins, and is the gray area an important thing that you've thought about?
It is a gray area, it's for sure. I mean, I have to say, the title of this whole talk, like Utopian Nightmare, Utopian Dream or Dystopian Nightmare, I don't think is the right choice, because
I wouldn't think you would.
I don't think it's utopian, because I don't think everybody will be happy and like holding hands and dancing all day. I think there's times where people will be like mad, you know, that they won't like the decision that happens, and it's politics. Politics is like that. But at least you'll be involved in it. I mean, right now we're mad about things that happen in Washington that we have absolutely nothing to do with and no control over.
But the great political theorist who was in the liberal tradition who actually addresses your question is John Stuart Mill, right? He says, look. He believes in liberty, and people should be free to have whatever opinion they want, live however they want, as long as they're not harming others. But here's something you can do. Here's a price they have to pay. If somebody living in a way that you disapprove of, they have to incur the cost of your disapproval. But here's something you can't do. You can't, as it were, organize the disapproval of the multitudes to try and stop them, because that's coercion. Right. He says you can express your disapproval, but you can't, as he puts it, parade your disapproval. So an anarchist could say, yeah, expressing disapproval of another, of his pooping on the street, is good, is okay, is permissible. That's part of your liberty. But parading your disapproval by organizing other people, that would go.
So James, practical question. Given our current, whatever you want to call it, democracy, so-called democracy, fake democracy, faux democracy, corporate oligarchy, whatever it is, how do we get from here? How do you imagine us even possibly conceivably getting from here to what you want, anarchy?
That's really the question. I think the first thing to say about that is that we live a much more anarchist life than we realize. And what I mean by that is that we make a lot of decisions locally, like on the shop floor, in our house, in our community, in our schools, that are done collectively without any kind of state hierarchical interference. So that's one of the reasons I don't think it's utopian. I think we practice a lot of anarchism right now, and we would have to like be aware of that and keep that part of our lives exactly as it is. So we wouldn't have to have this huge start over from the beginning kind of change. And I think another thing to say is, you know, anarchists, you don't have to wait for a revolution, although most anarchists are revolutionaries, but you don't have to wait for revolution. There's this thing called direct action, which is different from civil disobedience. It's a very important distinction. Civil disobedience is you basically acknowledge the power of the state, and you don't like one thing that the state is doing, so you break that law, and then you go, you go to jail, and you pay your time. Direct action is different. Direct action doesn't recognize the legitimacy of the state. You don't want to go to jail. You don't trust the jailers to not, you know, kill you or beat you or whatever it is that they do.
Wise thing.
Wisely. So it's a way of acting as if anarchism was already here. And so all of these demonstrations we're seeing, in Berkeley on the freeways and everything, that's direct action. That's they're not trying to be arrested.
So you're always in opposition to the state, always rejecting its legitimacy.
Exactly.
That makes it really hard.
Let me just point out one thing that is a step in this direction, and that's the marijuana laws. Marijuana is illegal at the federal level. The states, which are pretty large communities, but are nevertheless just ignoring that and creating a problem at the federal level and for banks. But yeah, that is, to me, an anarchy.
The states are doing direct action.
Yeah, that's what you mean by direct action. Just ignoring the federal government.
Yeah.
This will be our last question from our audience. Welcome to Philosophy Talk 3.
I'm Jasper from Berkeley.
How old are you, Jasper?
I'm 13.
Good for you.
So one of my neighbors was having a problem with her neighbor. Her neighbor would yell at them, and she filed a restraining order, and the police accepted it, and now like that neighbor can't yell at that person. In an anarchistic society, there wouldn't be the police. So how would you guys handle that situation?
Yeah, how would you do that?
That's a fantastic question. That's a really important point, that anarchist communities are completely capable of regulating themselves. I wouldn't call it policing themselves, because the police sort of stands above and outside of the community. But, you know, communities are deal with conflict all the time. I mean, there's ways to work out those kind of conflicts without the police. And I have to say, I think when the police come, they make everything 10 times worse, because they have guns and they have all this power and they can do whatever they want. And I would much rather have my neighbors work out a problem like that than have the police show up.
Certainly true. There are too many laws. There are too many criminal laws. The police show up too often with guns in situations that don't really call for guns, and nothing good comes of that. But, you know, James, this has been a great conversation. It hasn't been at all anarchic, so I'm going to thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Our guest has been James Martel. He's a professor of political science at San Francisco State University, editor of How Not to Be Governed, Readings and Interpretations from a Critical Anarchist Left. So, John, are you a critical anarchic leftist right now?
Well, there's a lot of things about libertarianism and a lot of things about anarchism that I like. I'd give them both 2 cheers out of 3. But I'm still young and haven't quite figured out my political philosophy yet.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think anarchists are right about one thing, about the logic of state authority. It naturally leads to domination and tyranny and over-coercion. But I don't know what to do about that, because I think without the state, things are a mess. But, you know, this conversation continues, and it won't be a mess, at Philosopher's Corner, at our online community of thinkers, where our motto is cogito ergo blogo. I think, therefore I blog. And you too can become a member of that community by visiting our website, philosophytalk.org.
Now we anarchically get rid of all speed limits, at least all the speed limits on speech. It's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, Josiah Warren was quite a guy, an inventor, musician, publisher. He had his own press, cast his own type, made his own plates. He was also a social reformer, America's first anarchist. Warren became convinced that private property and individual liberty were key to a successful society. So in 1851, he co-founded Modern Times, a town in Long Island. Individuals were encouraged to pursue their own interests. Everybody had a plot of land. There was no authority, no mayor, no police, no judges. Modern timers planted fruit trees by the streets to feed tramps and spare them the indignity of begging for food. It had its own currency and economy based on labor. People would pay with certificates indicating how many hours of work they did, exchanged at local time stores for goods and services that took the same time to produce. Each time store had a clock in plain sight. When the customer paid for goods, the time spent by the merchant was calculated, and the customer gave his labor note. Due to Mr. Time Store Man, on demand, 30 minutes of carpentry work or needlework or whatever. There were no actual profits in the capitalist sense. The village worked pretty well, though it only had 150 people and only lasted around 15 years, about how long a cat lives. But Modern Times was never a pure social experiment. For one thing, the times were full of religious and political upheavals. The Mormons, Christian Science, the Shakers, various community experiments, vegetarianism, abolitionism, water cures, suffragettes. People moved to Modern Times just because they'd heard of it. A lecturer, Mary Gove Nichols, moved there to dedicate Modern Times to free love. Now, despite the sexy reputation free love eventually gained, it was mainly devoted to getting the government out of women's personal lives. Sounds familiar. Also, as a protest, many forward-thinking women were throwing away their horrible disfiguring corsets and wearing bloomers, the bikini of its era. Modern Times was on a train line, and gawkers rode the rails, hoping to see free-love ladies in bloomers kissing men to whom they were not married. Kind of like taking a bus past Haight Street in 1967 to gape at hippies. Hubba hubba, but I'm sure disappointing. There was also a follower of the French philosopher Comte trying to throw positivism into the village anarchy mix, and there was a dentist who commuted, meaning he did not use that Modern Times money, but corrupt New York City cash. He was an armchair anarchist, a weekend anarchist. Plus, there was a food faddist, a woman who would eat only salt-free beans, and she starved to death. Come the Civil War, the whole enterprise fell apart. Warren left sadly, and the village changed its name to Brentwood, like a good little rail line suburb. One of the original residents wrote in a memoir in 1900 about the Modern Timers, quote, "They hoped that the sacrifices of pioneering in the howling wilderness would be of short duration, sure to be followed by enduring peace and plenty," unquote. The trouble is, there wasn't really a howling wilderness. It was Long Island. The train was right there. New York City was right there. They were already living in the promised land. All they had to do was keep that promise, like all of us. Instead, we set fire to the barn and run off to the circus. Human nature, I guess. Could use one of those time stores around here, though. I'd like to buy back about 30 years, please. How much is that? I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2014.
Our executive producer is David Demarest. Special thanks to Stephanie Wiseman, Marie Cartier, Matt Simon, Kiyozad Ayu, Dan Brandon, and Crystal Nickerson.
Our program is produced by Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research, and our marketing director is Dave Millar.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners in our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW, Local Public Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders, not even when they're true and reasonable.
The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you too can become a partner in our community of thinkers. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.